Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 279 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, Susan Fletcher speaks with Carolyn Sanderson about the importance of setting in her novels, how her love of the natural world and writing outside helps her bring poetry to her prose, and what really motivates her as a novelist.
Susan Fletcher is the award-winning author of seven novels. With her beautiful and poetic descriptions of her settings, whether it's of the North Norfolk coast or Glencoe in 1692, she has an unerring ability to transport us there and into the lives and minds of her characters. I'm here with Susan Fletcher, and we're a stone's throw away from Anne Hathaway's cottage just outside Stratford. And it's a very verdant scene outside, and we're also being circled in Susan's little house by ducks.
Yes.
It's a lovely setting in which to write.
It is. I'm very lucky to have been here for the past 2 years now, a bit more than 2 years. And I wrote the whole of my last book here, and it's been the perfect place to do it. The house that we're in, the very big windows, they are looking out onto the trees, and there's a duck pond, and it's been the perfect location to sit and write. It can be a distraction. The ducks can distract, but I feel, yeah, very lucky to be living here and writing here.
Well, we will talk about the effect and the importance of the natural world in your work a bit later, I think. I wanted to start by asking you possibly quite a difficult question, which is that your first novel, Eve Green, published in 2004, it was a huge success. It won the Costa First Novel Award and Betty Trask Award as well for a writer under 35. And you were 25 at the time. I mean, it was a dream start. So when you look back, how was that?
I look back now and I wish I'd enjoyed it more, is my first response, because it was wonderful, but I was so underprepared for it and so terrified, actually. That was my primary feeling through all of it, amazement, and I was just delighted. I'd written this book whilst living with my mum and working part-time at Blockbuster, which goes to show how long ago it was. And I never really thought it would find publication. So to find an agent, to find publication, and then to have this response was wonderful. But I felt very scared. I felt very scared that I was going on live radio. I felt very scared that I was having to sort of take to the floor, if you like, in a world I didn't yet feel part of. I didn't feel I almost deserved to be part of it. It was a very strange time, wonderful but nerve-wracking, and I now look back and I think I wish I'd just taken a big breath in and enjoyed it, because those moments don't happen often, and you certainly only have one chance of writing a debut novel. I look back and I think I wish I had just allowed myself to enjoy it more rather than have sleepless nights and feel rather frightened of my telephone.
Now, you described there how you were writing the novel while living with your parents and working at Blockbuster, but I think you actually started it when you were doing your master's in creative writing at the University of East Anglia.
Yes,
didn't
I did.
You? And you were working on something else which wasn't working.
Yes, yes,
all true.
Yes, it was my first term, the autumn term. I was working on something else. It was a cityscape novel. It wasn't working. I knew it wasn't. And I remember going to see my tutor at the Christmas, just before the Christmas break, and having a bit of a meltdown and just being advised to spend Christmas writing about a place I know. Just go and write. That was the advice. Go and write about something you know and love, and don't worry about trying to make it into a novel. Just sit down and write about a place you love. And so over that Christmas period, I began writing about a Welsh sheep farm that I had visited I was 11 when I first went there. They are a working farm, but they offer farm stays and they have horse riding, I think, to boost income. And I used to go on pony treks there. And I loved the place. It was quite a revelation going there and finding this wonderful windy part of the world that has cattle grids and ditches and sheepdogs that run down the lane after you. And I just spent that Christmas at UEA writing about this this farm that I remembered and loved, and all of a sudden I realised I was inventing characters and I was imagining a village that wasn't there, and that's how Eve Green started, yeah.
It's your first novel, but there's a theme in it which recurs, which is of the sort of orphan child, really, or a child who is removed from their home for some reason or another. And I wondered where you think that comes from. You're quite interested in that, aren't you? The theme of sort of loneliness and separation and loss as well.
They are recurring themes, and I didn't know they were for quite a long time. I think what intrigues me is survival, I think, self-reliance, and having a narrator or a lead character who is vulnerable but refuses to be cowed by it. I think it's more the sort of the fighter instinct that I'm most drawn to. From a very practical point of view, having a character who is a bit of a fighter and nosy and wants to find things out is a great tool. It makes your life much easier when you're writing if you have a protagonist who will open doors they aren't meant to and will talk to the person no one else does. It helps you hugely in creating the narrative and the plot. But yes, I think loss is always there in my books. If not the protagonist's loss, then people surrounding them have gone through a difficult time. And I don't think it's a conscious decision necessarily, but I just find it interesting. It's sort of the heart of the human experience, I suppose, how we deal with the blows that we get dealt. And books take me 2 or 3 years. I think you have to really love and feel affection for the people in your books in order to live with them for that long. And particularly with the main character, even more so if it's a first-person narrative, you have to really love them, to be honest. And I think having a character who from the word go is one step behind everyone else because they're an orphan or because of how they look or because of how they were raised or some experience that they've had, instantly I feel I'm on their side and I want to nourish them and I want to see them through the book safely. And I hope that's something that the reader will also feel.
I think your second novel, Oyster Catchers, is an interesting example of that. You're grimacing slightly. I don't know why. The main character is Moira, who I know reading the reviews of this book that some readers sort of felt that she was sort of too unattractive and difficult a character. I have to say, I found her absolutely fascinating and not difficult to warm to or sympathise with. But Moira is quite hard to like, I suppose, yeah. You could say.
Yeah, I mean, I did find it very hard writing, you know, the famously tricky second novel, and everything that happened with Eve Green had been so incredible and had sort of proved a whirlwind. So it was quite hard to settle down and really focus on the second book. But I remember thinking, wouldn't it be interesting to write a book in which all the people I care for most are actually the secondary characters, and at the heart of it is somebody who is difficult and challenging, but true, who isn't wildly unlike the rest of us, who is very honest about her misgivings. Also someone whose self-esteem is rock bottom. I mean, that's the heart of it. I think she does not care for herself at all, and other people try to. I found her very interesting, and I came away from the end of the book just wanting to hold her, to hug her and reassure her, because
that's how I felt.
It was a hard book to write because I don't think I took an easy route, and it is different to Eve Green. I wanted it to be. I've tried to make sure every book is different because I find that most stimulating for me. But it was a hard process, but consequently finishing it and seeing it published felt all the more rewarding.
And I should just say as well that I think in this novel, I mean, you get it in Eve Green as well, but there are two very striking resonant locations in Oyster Catchers. So it's partly set on the Welsh coast and partly set on the Norfolk coast. And I think this is where you really get a sense of how important setting and the feel of a location and atmosphere, all of that is in your writing too.
Yes, it is. It's the sort of first decision I make about any book so far. It's always been, where will I set it? I think quite often as well, the plot only comes into being once the locations have been decided upon. As a reader, I love a book that places me in a different time or landscape to the one I'm currently in, so that you can put the book down and walk away and think, gosh, I'm still there. I remember that with Barbara Kingsolver's novel, The Poisonwood Bible, which is set in the 1960s in the Congo. And I remember reading it here, actually, in Stratford-upon-Avon, and I put the book down and I went out to buy some milk or a loaf of bread. And I skirted the trees really warily because I kept thinking there'd be green mamba in them that would drop down and bite me. And I said, God, that's a good writer who has portrayed a land and a world so perfectly that despite the fact I'm now walking down the side of the A46, I'm checking the trees for poisonous snakes. I've never forgotten that. And I, because that's the kind of book I love to read, it's the kind of book I try to write so that the reader will feel they are in that location.
In terms of transporting us to a completely different place and time, that gives me a very good lead-in, I think, to talking about your third novel, Witchlight, which I think was originally published as Korag, which is the name of your main character. And this novel is set in the wilds of the Scottish Highlands in 1692. So it's your first historical,
first historical
novel. Wow. You're having to transport it in time as well as place. But I have been to Glencoe years ago, but it just, it did really bring it back to me. And I was interested to read that the novel had sort of come to you before that, partly through curiosity about witches and witchcraft, reading about the history of that, but also a trip to that part of Scotland, which had completely inspired you. And I suppose this, what you were just saying about having to know where a novel is going to be set before you start,
yeah,
that was the catalyst, I suppose, that brought it together by the sound of it.
It was. It was. This book stands out from the others for me in terms of how it came to be, because it was so, it just felt very serendipitous and strange and almost eerie, the coincidences, how things came about. I'd written two books and my two-book contract was therefore finished, so I was now out of contract, and I think that's an important factor, because you then, you have the slight nervousness of not having employment, but you also don't have a deadline, so you can immerse yourself and you can take your time in creating the new novel. I had relocated to Edinburgh. I had never seen Glencoe. I'd always wanted to. For years I'd wanted to. And I drove up there, it was in the autumn, and I stopped at the National Trust for Scotland Visitor Centre. I didn't think at this point that I would necessarily be writing about Glencoe, but I knew I wanted to write about the Scottish landscape. And in the Visitor Centre, I was reading all the placards about the Glencoe Massacre and how it happened, and that was all fascinating to me. But then I saw probably five lines on the wall about Korag, who was rumoured to be a witch. She was alive at the time of the Glencoe massacre, and legend has it that she made the massacre a far less thing, if such a thing can be done. There should have been 300 or 400 people killed that night in the glen, and only sort of 37 or 38 died, and they think that she basically predicted it with the second sight or her third eye. She knew it was coming and she was able to warn the clansmen, so they escaped in time. And I just thought this was so fascinating to me. I wanted to write about her. I knew it. I just stood in the visitor centre in my walking boots and wet anorak and thought, there you are. It's you. You're the next 3 years of my life. I absolutely knew it. And then I continued driving into Glencoe Village and I parked the car and I was having a walk thinking about her. And I saw this lovely cottage and I just thought, I'm going to live there. That's where I'm going to live when I write the book. And there seemed to be people living there. It was no reason why I should be about to rent this cottage, but went back to Edinburgh.
It was your third eye was telling
you. My third eye, yes, exactly. And I went back and Googled the name of this cottage, and it was a holiday let, and I wrote to them and I said, we're coming into the winter, I can't afford to stay with you for very long, but could I possibly hammer out a bargain with you if it's through the winter months when it's going to be empty anyway? So they said yes, and I lived there and began the book. And it was a really happy 3 years of my life writing it. I loved her. I'd gone from Moira in Oystercatchers, who is difficult and withdrawn and spiky. And Korag is the complete opposite. She is just amazed at how wonderful life is in a time when it really probably wasn't, but generous to a fault, amazed by nature. I loved writing as her. I loved exploring Glencoe. I really did write most of that book outdoors.
You like to write outdoors.
Yes, I love it. I feel kind of unfettered, I suppose. I can sit there with my pencils and notepad and thermos flask and just write away. I can do it all day, and I think I'm more productive than I am when I'm at my desk most of the time. But certainly with this book, I wanted to know Glencoe intimately as she would have done. I wanted to see it in all the different seasons. So yeah, I was outside a lot. And there's certain parts of Glencoe that I've discovered are particularly good writing places. And there's one rock just above the road. I'd say it's about a sort of 4 or 5 minute walk up from up the side of the mountain. And this wonderful stone, which has been there for millennia, it's curved so it fits my back. And I would just nestle into it. And I'd spend hours up there just writing.
It's also interesting as a novel that's based essentially on real events. Mm. The other interesting aspect of it is you have two narrators. So it's told partly in the voice of Korag, who's been imprisoned for witchcraft eventually. And so we meet her at the start of the book when she is incarcerated. And she's telling her story to a man called Charles Leslie, who yes. I believe was a real man. So presumably you have to be fairly faithful to what actually happened. But at the same time, you're making your own story of it.
Yes, I think this is sort of the great debate about historical fiction. If you're writing historical fiction, how accurate do you need to be? And I think everybody probably has a different answer to that. This is my first foray into it. And I made a decision very early on that if I was to write about anyone who had existed, I would try and stick as closely to the information I had about them as possible. I knew too with this book that I would only write anything negative about someone who had lived if we have the proof that they might have committed atrocities, if you like. The person I'm thinking of when I'm saying this is John Dalrymple, the Master of Stair, and there is so much documentation that suggests that he was the mastermind behind the Glencoe massacre. In his own hand, we have how he wanted to cut off the MacDonald clan root and branch. He talks about leave no man under 70 alive. I mean, it's very brutal language. So I felt able to portray him in a bad light because we have in his own hand his intent. But everybody else I wanted to just treat respectfully and accurately. Korag was... I could afford to really play with Korag because she may not even have existed. She is just rumour, she's folklore. So that gave me a lovely freedom with her. I think, looking at it now, I think it was a good story to enter the world of historical fiction with as a writer, because there is a lot of documentation, there's a lot of written evidence that I could use as a base. But there also is, through the character of Korag, a complete blank page that I could fill as I chose.
You're a wonderfully poetic writer, and I wondered how long you spend sort of routinely honing your writing, the way you describe something.
A long time is probably the truth. My first love was poetry, so that's what I wanted to be when I was younger. I wanted to be a poet. And I would read poetry far more than I'd read fiction, and that probably is still the case. But I felt, by the time I got to university, I realised I was not particularly good at poetry. Nevertheless, I loved a poet's attention to detail. I loved the importance of finding just the right word and paring everything down so you don't describe something at length, you actually shorten it into just the right amount of words, as a poet does. So all the things I love about trying to write poetry, I've just tried to move into prose and incorporate the same rules and the same techniques that I'd used when writing my bad poetry. I think for me, rhythm is a really important thing. Having something that feels like it flows, and indeed having something that doesn't feel like it flows, and if you want to have a certain effect in the narrative, I read my work out loud a lot, and I think that's what probably takes the time. If I have a secret weapon, it's probably that, talking out loud to myself. So must be very hard to live with.
And the ducks.
And the ducks.
So after A Silver Dark Sea, another contemporary novel, you wrote a young adult novel, A Little in Love.
I did.
Which tells the story of Eponine from Les Misérables, from her point of view.
Yes, she does.
Well,
yes.
Why did you want to do that, and how did it come about that you wrote for a slightly younger audience?
It's a sort of rather unromantic answer that I have. I was basically commissioned to do it. So Chicken House, the publishing house, approached my agent and said they had this idea of writing the story of Eponine from Eponine's point of view, and they were wondering if I would like to do it. And I'd never written for the young adult market. I think they approached me on the back of Eve Green. I think Chicken House read Eve Green, recognised it was adult fiction, but that it is accessible. It is not, it could be YA, Eve Green, I think.
Yes, I think that's true.
And it just felt like a really lovely invitation and a really interesting one. I'd come to the end of my second two-book deal, so I was out of contract. And actually, at the time, I was reading a book called Ahab's Wife. And I remember thinking, gosh, that's a great idea, that she has gone into Moby Dick. She has found two or three sentences that allude to Captain Ahab's wife back home and has simply taken those two or three sentences and created a whole novel about this one character. And I remember thinking, gosh, wouldn't it be fun to do a similar thing, to find a novel in which there is a character we know very little about and spin it on its head. And lo and behold, within about 2 weeks, I had this phone call from Chicken House. And
your third eye again.
I
third eye.
I know. So I thought, well, I have to say yes to that. And it was a challenge because I think they wanted the whole thing done in 8 months. And normally I'm a sort of two-year kind of girl. And by writing for the young adult market, you are invariably writing in a slightly different way to how you would if you're writing for the adult market. Not by much, but I knew that something like dialogue would feature much more in YA because pace is of more importance to a YA novel. You can't afford to spend pages describing something or taking your time. It has to have a zip to it, and dialogue helps very much with that. And that appealed to me because I've never had much confidence with my dialogue. I've preferred steering away from it. So I thought, right, here is a really lovely challenge. I will learn from doing this. So I knuckled down, read Les Mis, the unabridged version, which took up probably 3 of the 8 months I'd been allotted.
Yes, it's quite a tome, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, absolutely. You can prop open some very big doors with that book. It was a really lovely experience. Everything about it was different and fresh to writing for the adult market. Lovely experience, yeah.
And I wondered, when you look back now on all your novels, what you feel are the prevailing themes that run through them. We've talked about very, very different settings and periods that your books are set in.
Certainly, landscape invariably features in all of them, and I think it always will. Having a very clear setting, a very specific time and place, really appeals to me. I love writing a book that has a landscape in it that is rich and exciting and different. I love writing that, so I think that will always continue. Certainly with the protagonists, I can now see the similarities that they all share, which is this vulnerability and loss and having had to go through a form of suffering, but partnering that with a defiance and digging deep and not being faint-hearted, even if they want to be. I love that kind of character. I think sort of sticking to their guns and trying. I have characters who just try even when it looks really hard. I find that very interesting. I've realised too, actually, that despite the fact that 3 of my novels are contemporary, I now am more interested in the historical side of fiction. The fledgling idea I now have for the 8th book is historical again. And having realised that this is now my preference has been actually a very lovely thing. So actually maybe I am more of a historical novelist than a contemporary one, and it makes complete sense. So often I will read history books just for fun, and so I think actually no, this is where I'm leaning to. Who knows if it will continue, who knows if this fledgling idea will fledge, but that is something that I've now realised, that I'm 7 books down the line and I think I'm a historical fiction writer above all else, but hopefully one that's got a poet's heart.
And what's your wildest ambition for your writing?
Oh, God. I would love to be able to do this full-time for as long as I want to. And that probably doesn't sound as exciting as you, exciting an answer as you probably were hoping for, but that would be reward enough to be able to dedicate all my time professionally to writing. Would be a wonderful thing to be able to do that. I remember when I started UEA when I was 22, I remember being in the queue to register, and there were lots of other people who were joining the same course, the same creative writing course, and we all said hello and introduced ourselves to each other, and we went off down the pub, as you do when you first join university. And everyone was talking about what they wanted from their writing life, what they wanted from the course. And I felt so out of my depth. I remember people talking about how they want to mirror the existentialism and to do a postmodernist take on so-and-so. And I just remember thinking, I just want to write the kind of book that you will read one more chapter of before bed, or just one more chapter, and then suddenly realise it's one in the morning. That's all I really wanted to do at UEA when I was 22, is write that kind of book that people attempted to just read that little bit more of. And I don't think that's changed. I think if I can continue to do that, I will consider myself really fortunate.
That was Susan Fletcher in conversation with Carolyn Sanderson. You can find out more about Susan on the RLF website. And that concludes episode 279, which was recorded by Carolyn Sanderson and produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 280, Tina Pepler speaks with Jane Draycott about fictionalizing trauma, the limits of the internet, and cross-cultural mentoring. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.